Welcome to this special video cast of the Weather Pod with Alan Thorpe and me, David Rogers. Our guests today are Jerry Languasa and Makoto Sua, who've joined us to discuss the prospects and opportunities for weather and climate services in Africa. Many of you know Jerry well from his tenure as Assistant and Deputy Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization and as Chief Executive of the South African Weather Service. Makoto is a senior disaster risk management specialist at the World Bank. Currently, he's leading and supporting a wide range of hydromet projects in Africa. Prior to joining the bank, Makoto also worked for the WMO in their Geneva office and in their regional office in Nairobi. Jerry and Makoto, welcome to the Weather Pod.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Yes, we've been looking forward to this.
So to kick things off, I'd like to start by asking you about your perceptions of the state of weather services across the continent. Jerry, you've been working for many years within weather services and also have a global view of the public sector. How is Africa faring in terms of improving its public services and its national meteorological related services in particular?
Hi, David. Yeah, thanks. I think one of the key things is that it is a mixed picture. So there are centers of excellence and there are those that are really struggling. Not that it's something new. I think it has been ongoing for quite a while, but COVID-19 and the pandemic has just tended to magnify the problem where the Met services have not been as strong as they could be, both in the past and in the present. So centers of excellence, I think there are some in the north. You could count Morocco, for example, Nigeria, in the northern hemisphere of Africa, but also in the southern parts, you could count South Africa and probably Tanzania to some extent, and Kenya. But for the rest, I think the struggles continue. And most of those struggles really have to do with three things. It's technology, finance, as well as human skill.
That's interesting. Makoto, what's your thinking on this? I guess I'm interested in whether you think the priorities of governments really include the meteorological and hydrological services, and so that they actually recognize the need to make targeted investments and sort of increase the core support in this area. Do they really take it seriously, the governments?
Well, as you know, a number of African countries are facing serious climate and disaster challenges. So it's not surprising that in many countries, the climate agenda is high priority. Since hydromet and the climate data and the services should inform that the various climate actions, it is not surprising to see that some national meteorological and hydrological services have made good progress in recent years. However, in other countries, prioritizing the climate action has not been necessarily translated into investments in hydromet services. In those countries, there is somehow a disconnect between the climate agenda and the hydromet services. Why is that? Let's take a look at the World Bank's the latest Africa Climate Business Plan. Well, the plan identified that the five strategic pillars, including food security and the resilient rural economy, ecosystems, sustainability, and the water security, low carbon and resilient energy, region, cities, and green mobility, and climate shocks and risk governance. Well, any countries that the priority climate action could be as broad as, you know, those five strategic pillars. I mean, we can argue that the meteorological and hydrological services can underpin all those, you know, the pillars and lay the foundation for evidence-based actions. But in many countries I'm working with, the use cases of hydromet services in such areas are still limited. That's not necessarily easy to convince decision makers why investments in hydromet services are needed to support such climate actions. Well, at the same time, that we have to be aware that there are a number of the competing priorities for the government. In addition, as Jerry mentioned, we now have to keep a close eye on how the post-COVID world would impact government's priorities. Meaning those who are working in the hydromet issues, will continue to argue that sufficient public funding is needed to ensure the provision of key public services like early warning. But we also need to think about the ground reality. I would not be surprised if the allocation of public financing or the human resources to the hydromet sector does not dramatically improve over the next 5 years or longer in a number of countries. The question is, should we give up? My answer is definitely no. With rather limited resources available in the public sector, I think the key question now is how the public sector can leverage the capacity of the entire hydromet ecosystem, or whether enterprise to respond to the needs of users, and what strategic role should the public sector play. So in summary, there are different levels of progress in the continent, with some countries facing a lot of challenges to make a progress. But even those who are better off, they might need to think how to sustain and improve services in the resource-constrained environment for the next few years.
I suppose it's a bit surprising to me, in a way, you're making the point that we have to make the point that meteorology, weather and climate predictions are incredibly important to save lives and to protect infrastructure and develop economies. In a sense, perhaps we take it a bit for granted in the developed world that those things are obvious. I think you sort of said perhaps that point needs to be made still. I find that a little bit surprising, given, you know, how vulnerable people are to these sorts of phenomena. I don't know if you have a view on that, Makoto.
Well, but there are a number of things that they keep feeding the people, including the, for example, the agriculture productivities, or that we need to, the government have to ensure that, people, the kids are going to school every day, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's really that the matter of the prioritization and exercise. And I think that the government do recognize the importance of hydromet services or disaster risk management. But then again, with limited, scarce at the financial and human resources, I think that they haven't really done or they have not been able to do enough for that sector.
I wanted just to move on to another point, which is sort of implied by what you've said so far, both of you. You know, one of the weaknesses that's been highlighted by yourselves and by the WMO is the problem of sustaining high-quality meteorological observations. And of course, we know the problem is not limited to the African continent. But since this is such a large landmass, its influence on global weather patterns is really significant. And the paucity of data really does impair the overall quality of global weather predictions and weather forecasts for Africa. I wonder how you see this changing in the future.
Well, we have seen that the development partners are investing more in hydromet services in Africa in recent years. Investment from the World Bank alone have quadrupled over the last 10 years, and most of the projects do have a component supporting an observing system. So it would be an interesting exercise to assess how such investments have changed the availability of meteorological data from the continent, which in turn, contributed to the improvement of overall quality of numerical weather prediction and weather forecasts. While I don't have any solid evidence to assess that, we know there are still a lot to be done to improve the availability of data from Africa. I think that there are two issues to address to improve data availability. One issue is the sustainability of the observing system, and the other is to make data more readily available and accessible. A number of colleagues from National Meteorological and Hydrological Services attribute the sustainability challenge to the lack of funding and also human resources, which is true. Support from the government to the hydromet sector is not always is strong. Well, development partners may support capacity development, but retaining skillful engineers and then IT experts in the public sector is often difficult because salary in the public sector is not necessarily competitive. So I think by now the sustainability of observing network is a well-recognized challenge, both by national meteorological and hydrological services themselves and then also by development partners. But if you ask whether such a recognition has led to the significant improvement of the situation, the answer is unfortunately no. Well, one hypothesis one might have is it is purely the funding problem. If there is enough funding for operational maintenance, the sustainability issue can be solved. That removes that the strategic observing financing facility staff argues that you know, data to be assimilated in the numerical weather prediction are global public goods, and thus the need to be financed by global partners you know, around the world. I think in reality, the issue could be a little bit more complex and more to do with the NMHS's institutional capacity itself, not only money, but funding is definitely part of the equation. I think that also the better alignment of incentives for data exchange is important. The logic behind the global data exchange is, as I understood, if everybody shares data, everybody should get benefits through, for example, the improved quality of global numerical weather prediction. And this should be working as an incentive mechanism for data, for data exchange. Well, apparently this is not working as such, at least in a number of countries we are working with at the moment. One area we are providing support to those countries is to ensure they access and utilize global numerical weather prediction products so that they can improve the quality of forecasts rather quickly in a cost-effective way. More operational use of such global numerical weather, you know, prediction products could also eventually reinforce this entire incentive mechanism for data exchange, because more benefits an NMHS finds in global numerical weather prediction, the stronger the incentive should be for them to contribute to its improvement through the global data exchange. But we will see. Well, another aspect we need to consider is how the community can benefit from data other than, you know, those from NMHS's. There are a number of non-state actors in Africa who are operating their own meteorological stations, including commercial farmers, mining sectors, academia, etc. We also see that some actors are crowdsourcing some type of data, as well as using new technologies to collect targeted data. These would offer for countries to further beef up their capacity to observe meteorological phenomena. So obviously there are challenges to address data availability in Africa, but there are a few emerging opportunities and new ideas as briefly discussed. I mean, but those opportunities to me are currently still existing as isolated dots. We do need to connect those dots to provide more holistic solutions going forward.
So picking up on that, I'd like to ask Jerry, you know, as Makota has just said, we talk about observations are used by many other services and are produced by are available from many sources. We see moves in Europe and the long-standing policies in the US to make meteorological data and other data for that matter freely available to use and reuse as spurring a lot of economic activity, and there are numbers in Europe which are quite spectacular in terms of the contribution to the economy from an open data policy. Do you think increased investment in the public sector can lead to more open data policies throughout the continent?
It's a complex challenge, which I think needs and requires that we view this through a very different lens. I think from the Hydromet community, this problem has been viewed purely as a humanitarian challenge. But actually it is not. It's an economic challenge. I think the mindset that we have in most med services that selling data is a solution to the problem of investments or a lack of investments by governments in Hydromet, and especially in observation networks. It seems to have come out, and probably even the view, that this is a humanitarian problem, for me is a remnant of the emergence of the science and the strengthening of the science from the post-World War II era, if I may say so, where I think the emphasis was always about, you know, lives lost and how you're going to save lives through this technology and the science. And the improvements have been made to a large extent, again, taking into cognizance various players. The private sector had always had a role to play, whether it was the production of the role for a thermohydrograph, the paper itself or the mechanisms in it. And Met Services never queried that. In some cases in the developing world, Met Services had little workshops. I remember when I took over the Weather Service in 2003, there was a workshop that produced rain gauges, right? Tipping bucket rain gauges, nothing automatic. But this was already in the 21st century. So the transition from the old manual technology to the current technologies, that innovation was not largely driven by Met Services, even though the demand was there, but it was driven by the private sector. And the reason I raise this is because to a very large extent, if we see meteorology and hydromet data as economic data, all right, just as it is about production, and just as the World Bank is concerned, for example, about poverty, poverty relates to a whole value cycle in from food production, with things reaching the markets, people being employed, and so forth and so on. And so to a large extent, if we view it as economic data, then I think we have an opportunity to address it in a very different way. Again, taking lessons from Europe, right? I remember one hydromet director from a Scandinavian Met Service getting an award from government for making data freely available. So the reason I say it's an economic issue means that government intervention, not in the only in terms of providing revenue or money or finance to the Met Service, but actually in policy and policy directive is important. Because in the end, I view it in this way. If you were if this was your household, right? The world was your household, and you trying to manage risks to the economy. And here's one risk which contributes up to 80% of your risks on your economy. That would be, if you were to prioritize everything else that you would need to do to ensure that you mitigate against those risks and you build some form of buffer against them, then you would certainly, that would be one of your highest priorities. But at the moment, ironically, because it is viewed, hydromet is viewed as a humanitarian issue, it is way down there in terms of the priority list, right? And we're trying all attempts, disaster risk, and the narrative around disaster risk, and hopefully that raises the impact. But again, we continue to simply view that through the lens of how many lives saved, in fact, not even saved. We actually look at it in relation to how many lives lost, right? And the public media, that's what we talk about. That's what, you know, how many people were killed in the recent flood. And you say, in relation to everyone else that uses that road, in relation to everyone else, or all the other economic impact on that stretch of road where that those three, four lives were lost, what is the impact of that economic loss through transport, through the road itself, through the lack of movements of goods and services on that stretch of road because you've had a major flood that has wiped out the road? And again, I'm not downplaying the importance of lives and livelihoods. What I am arguing for is that I think we need to change the narrative and say, if I was a prime minister of a country and 80 to 90% of all disasters are related to this one or this area, I would then make every effort to say, what then do I need to do? And if one of those questions is invest in the observation networks that will give me much more insights into what this hazard is about and how I might then mitigate that hazard using various mechanisms, policy interventions, economic policy changes, including a policy change where government says all this data will be made freely available. Because I think for now, it's sort of left to the heads of Met Services to make that decision. And some, unfortunately, are still making the decision that it's a revenue source rather than a solution source for mitigating against risks to the economy, including livelihoods, which then impact on individuals in the economy. So I think a shift in emphasis is absolutely crucial and is important, especially now. Now that we also will see the impact of COVID-19. Now, one of the major impacts of COVID-19 is economic, right? In a globally connected economy, the impact of COVID has been major. And for most weather services on the continent, who other than the government grant are dependent on aviation revenue, right? The lack of any aircraft flying has meant a decimation of that particular revenue stream, which then has a down, accentuates the problem of not having sufficient resources. So even those med services that have a policy environment that allows them to retain some form of revenue that they raise outside of the government grant that they are given, for most of those, that particular resource has now gone. And so I think it'll probably take 2 to 3 to 5 years, Makoto, in my view, for this impact to be reversed, unless there is a fundamental shift in how governments do some of the policy intervention in relation to COVID-19. And I've spoken about how I think every economic shock, right, governments go to infrastructure investments as a mechanism to fuel the economies again. And so one of the issues then for me is how can you have a policy directive that almost says that for every stretch of road that you construct, there must be some observing network that goes with that. Whether it's that one for stretch of 10 kilometers, say there's an automatic weather station or there's some technology that you have to invest in to ensure that you have some way of knowing what the hazards that road is going to face over the next 10 years and so forth and so on. So for me, if you do that, especially when you look at what kind of technologies we intend to invest in, right, for this sustainable pathway, because in the end, climate change is an economic problem, right? It was a choice about energy source. So if you are going to invest in alternative energy to what has created the problem, then you say, well, for wind, whether it's for wind, for solar, for any other alternative energy source, a network is a fundamental requirement to be able to understand the efficacy of that energy source and its ability to supply what is required for the world going forward. So in conclusion, I think on that, just that thought process, I would say that climate change is a fundamental economic problem. The problem of MET services and the lack of hydromet and the lack of observations and networks is because we viewed it through a very narrow humanitarian and have made arguments continuously through this very narrow window that basically says it's a humanitarian problem about loss of lives and not that it is a fundamental economic problem. And because it's a fundamental economic problem, that it does require a certain level of high policy intervention by governments, which includes not just investments, but in fact, policy directives that can help resolve some of those issues, including making data freely available.
We talked about post-COVID, and we talk about build back better. And what you're really saying is that, you know, we're moving to a digital economy, whether it's, you know, improving road transportation, it's using information more effectively. So the meteorological services should be at the heart of that digital economy. I mean, there's certainly major players in it and think differently about how they view themselves as organizations. And I think you make a very important point about this sort of shift from the focus of the humanitarian focus of an economic one. It really is essential.
Yeah, I think it really chimes with a number of thinkers at the moment on economics, and in particular how to assess the value of particular information or data streams. And actually that evaluation of created value by the meteorological community, you know, feeds very well into an economics lens that you're talking about. And we have, I guess what you said, which I find quite appealing, is that we have to be more sophisticated, perhaps, in the way that we do those assessments to make the argument. I just wanted to move us on, if I may, to a sort of related topic, Jerry, if I could keep with you. We know that regional cooperation is quite a trend in many parts of the world, you know, including in the meteorological world, where, you know, smaller countries see the benefit from pooling together knowledge and resources. And, you know, obviously for myself coming from Europe, one sees that the European countries have really done a lot of this. They've created several structures like EUMETSAT, EUMETNET, which is, you know, a network of 31 European Met services, and of course ECMWF, as a way of creating a kind of cost-efficient and sharing infrastructure amongst their national Met services. I wonder, Jerry, is there any sense in which this could work in Africa? And if not in a way, why not?
Well, it's actually interesting because I think there was a period in the 70s and 80s where drought was a major focus, right? You might recall Ethiopia was sort of the kid with a swollen stomach was the postcard for the continent and the vagaries of drought in the continent. During that period, let me not say ironically, but what was created as a response, right, to that major crisis were these various drought monitoring centers. And these were created on the continent through economic zones. So the continent is divided. So you have SADC, which is the Southern African Development Community. Then you have ECOWAS, which is on the east. And so forth and so on. And these institutions were largely created to then come up with seasonal outlooks. And they created seasonal outlook forums or drought monitoring forums. And so on a quarterly basis, community would come together, meteorologists, community from academia and so forth. And there would be a discussion on what the latest outlook or forecasts, seasonal forecasts, or long-term forecasts look like. And then there would be, at the end of that, an advisory or document would be published, which basically goes out to the public and says, you know, we're anticipating a wetter than normal or drier than normal season coming forward. So there is a foundation for cooperation. I think the question then is, how do you evolve that from what it is currently, which is purely focused on droughts, or to a large extent focused on droughts? And I think the emerging climate services context is helping to do that, but it is not, in my view, as consistently utilized through the continent in the same way, right? And I think it points to one, the opportunities that there are there. So if you go into SADC, SADC has taken advantage of a completely allied project. And I'll come back to this later on about leadership and management and what that means for what has been largely insular institutions purely focused on their own backyard. So I have a problem with my observation networks. I have a problem with technology. I have a problem with money and people and people not looking outside of themselves and their institutions to what else is there in the country, for example. I'm not even going outside of one's country, but what else is there in the country that I can take advantage of, which can then help resolve some of my challenges, but also make a contribution to the rest of it. So you might have heard of the Sky Project, which is a radio observatory, which I think is shared between a number of countries, including South Africa and in SADC, and also is shared with Australia. A spin-off of all of this has been high-performance computing capability being made available to digest all of this data that would come out of this, right? I then worked with the Center for High Performance Computing, which was set up purely for physics research, and saying, here's an opportunity for us, for you to work as a backup for the Weather Service, which doesn't have a backup for its high performance computing. But out of that, then spun out a project which basically said all of these SADC countries that have some role to play in this radio observatory were receiving supercomputers at universities to start training people on how to run them, how to maintain them, and everything else that goes with it. And a spin-off out of that, just to cut it short, is that one of the beneficiaries then of that project was training in hydrometeorology and running models and so forth. And so SADC has taken advantage of that, and that component is now helping to fuel climate services in SADC.
So do you think there is an appetite then for such cooperation?
There is an appetite for cooperation. I think it needs to be encouraged in many ways. Okay. And I think one of the things that we need to take advantage of is probably this transition of the continent to a single economic trading area. Because I think there it starts to present huge opportunities on the scale that we have seen in Europe, for example, where everything from procurement to the ability to put together continental scale institutions that are focused on resolving a particular problem would be highly possible. But again, those will require, I think, policy intervention, but also, if I may challenge Makoto, I think different thinking from all the multi-donor agencies and aid agencies in general, to saying how then do you foster and support this kind of innovation that helps move everything forward and hopefully resolve these perennial problems about data accessibility, data availability, and even observation networks.
So Makoto, how do we do that? As Jerry says, you know, these initiatives need money. So what kind of possibilities are there in the development community?
Yeah, well, at least I think that there is an overall recognition within the development community that hydromet is transboundary issues, which requires a good regional collaboration. And this is that the area we can expect also the economies of scale. And as discussed earlier, we know that the availability of financial and human resources in number of countries in the hydromet sector is rather limited, especially in those small countries. There are a number of small countries in Africa. So it makes sense that those countries, pool resources as much as possible and to create more cost-effective system to produce high-quality services. And in fact, that as Jerry already mentioned, there are a number of certain initiatives in every sub-region of Africa to bring national meteorological hydrological services together, including that the Climate Outlook Fora in the sub-regional, at the sub-regional level, and the development of some of the common guidance products to cover a group of countries nearby, for instance, those for severe weather forecasting and flash floods. And of course, the regional trainings are very, very common. Can we or should we do more than what are being done today? Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of things that each sub-region can do to strengthen the regional collaboration to benefit all, from regional data exchange. I mean, to some extent that exists. But if you look at very closely, for example, right now I'm working in West Africa, but data exchange really relies on the personal relationship between the regional center and the National Meteorological Hydrological Services. So this is not really institutionalized that when the persons move on, that sometimes, that the data from flow from the particular countries goes to nearly zero. So that is still happening. So there's a lot to do to strengthen for example, the regional data exchange. Also the pooling resources, the computational resources and niche expertise. I mean, many countries request us to, to do that limited area, running the limited area models and have the high performance computers. And of course, we can ask the question whether it's really the cost effective investments to, all the 48 sub-Saharan African countries have their supercomputers to run the models. Perhaps the answer is no. And we don't have any luxury to do that at the current, the financial and the human capacity constraints. Joint research and development activities is definitely needed. I mean, that the research is needed to improve the services, but I think that research agenda is not well financed in Africa so far. How are we going to move forward? How to advance this discussion? I think that also requires and benefit from the stronger regional collaboration. And then also that the common market, as Jerry also mentioned, the common market, creating the common market to attract more the private sector investments. There's a whole lot of the possibilities by strengthening the regional collaboration. But of course, doing so requires a strong political will. And if that exists, I'm sure that many development partners, including the World Bank, would support that. Regional collaboration in hydromet services in Europe is definitely a good example, which many other regions can learn from.
And it's encouraging to hear that. I think the World Bank would obviously want to support regional issues. I think where we need to also start to think about innovative ways is, for example, artificial intelligence and the current cloud computing. I think we it's now possible to move away from assuming that every single med service must have a supercomputer or high performance computer. I think if you're going to run a very local area model and you don't necessarily have that capacity, the capacity in the cloud is there and should be able to do this. But of course, it still begs the question, do you have the skills base to do that? Do you have the people in your service to do that? But I think if we start to think, where cloud computing is or was 5 years ago, where it is at present, and where it would be in the next 5 years, it should be possible, I think, to invest in a very small med services ability to tap into the cloud, run its own model. So in other words, what I'm saying is we've seen a lot of demonstration projects on multi-hazards. We've seen how we've used in the past the ability of those that have the resource, a supercomputer, to run numerical weather prediction models and run multi-ensembles and then make the output available to the country that is not able to produce that on its own. And they then ingest it in their local information and make that available to the public. Those were the demonstration projects that were built on this, in a sense, I don't know whether to call it concentrated ability in only a few. But what cloud computing does present is an opportunity to, I don't want to say democratize that, but maybe that's not the right word. But in a way, decentralize that and allow even a small med service that has the people and the resources to run a small local area model to do so, even at 3.3 kilometer resolution.
You could argue you need to move away even from there, and then for example, look in tropical Africa. They have access to a 4 kilometer tropical model, cloud convection permitting model from the Met Office, which can be used from a forecast point of view. When we look at regional cooperation, it's how do you go beyond that? How do you say, well, I have the tools to understand what's happening with rainfall. How do I use the information? And then I need to collaborate on a regional scale in order to utilize that information, to combine that information with information from other sectors. How do I improve the road? It's providing real-time information combined with the models, but my focus has got to shift away from I need to be a modeler to I need to be a user of models. And isn't it great that I can use the cloud, and having access to the cloud is the tricky part, to having the bandwidth to take that information, to take the digital information, blend it with other information, and then turn it into something that is really useful. And it's, we haven't got there yet.
No, we haven't got there yet. And this is why my sense is that it's a requirement for government policy intervention, but also in a way advocacy from this community. Along the same lines that I'd argued earlier, because governments are making investments or inviting the private sector to make investments in broadband, right? But that's driven by a very separate community, which is purely interested in telecoms and cell phones that are faster and are able to take better pictures, right? And yet none of us in our community, I think, are sitting at that very same table and saying this is critical infrastructure for allowing for certain developments and for this community to make even better inputs into economic models and how you actually safeguard economic investments from this these multiple hazards. And I think until we start to make those noises and make that known, until we make that known, then I think we basically face the same challenge, which is that these investments continue to diminish over time with a huge global impact.
I mean, it's been a fascinating discussion about cooperation and regional cooperation. I guess we've heard in previous WeatherPod episodes from other guests that there's also really a great opportunity for global cooperation here, because many of the global models actually are crying out for evaluation, for validation data that's not ingested into the initial conditions of the forecasts, but which are incredibly useful to test processes and accuracy of weather predictions. And these national, local measurements, to have access for those for the global centres outside of the country in question is becoming quite a theme of importance. And it shows that actually, in a way, it is really a global weather enterprise. You know, we all actually benefit if these flows of information, people and training can be viewed very much at the larger scale, in effect. So just with that sort of reflection, can I move on to something I think you've mentioned, Jerry, already, but I wanted just to pick it up a bit more. And that is the role of the private sector in Africa. You know, we've heard in the WeatherPod many times that we know the private sector is a very big contributor to the overall global weather enterprise. And there's increasing expertise and ability of the private sector to contribute. Yet, on the other hand, you know, the relationship between the public, private and academic sectors are not always as smooth and as straightforward as one might like. And I just wonder, Jerry, how do you feel about this in terms of its developments in the African context?
Well, I think we touched on the theme of the quality of services, because I think that's where the main contention really sits. It's not so much in the fact that there's technology which is produced by the private sector to acquire the data, right? To store it, to transmit it. I think all of those things are kind of understood, that the roles and responsibilities, which are sort of assigned and agreed, some are not necessarily written. And then I think it's on the services side where the value add and innovation space is happening. And I think that's where there's opportunity for greater cooperation. And I call it cooperation because my sense is that it calls for leadership and management. Now, often, what do I mean by that? I think what I mean by that is that it's the ability of individuals who are given a responsibility to head up an institution. And in the case of the WMO, often those institutions are seen as permanent representatives of the countries, not of their institution, but of the countries that they represent. And so when they come to the table, it's which in representing the country, they should then have an ability to speak, not only for their national institution, but for everyone else who's involved in the weather enterprise at a national level. I mean, you'd be amazed, in every single of the countries on the continent, the number of networks that exist outside of the medicines, whether it's in the agriculture department, whether it's run by academia, as Marco or earlier alluded to, whether it's run by a research institute, which is focused purely on the citrus industry. So if it's grain in agriculture, often you find these boards, maize boards or whatever, they have their own institute that does the research for them and advises them. And they have networks of their own. And often those networks are not even assimilated or at least used or recognized or acknowledged by the National Weather Services. So, which for me makes even the conversation very difficult, because often even those institutions have private sector players who might be providing them a crop forecast, for example, or spray condition forecasts, etc., which is not what your weather service on average is able to do, and most certainly not even the agriculture departments, right? Because let's face it, we are not yet in our government institutions, we're not yet where we have governments of the future, where there's integration and, in a sense, departments are representative of the challenges that we face. They're still very silo-driven on a thematic basis. So the Department of Agriculture operates on its own, has its own systems, and I don't think the continent is necessarily unique in that respect. So it was great to see when you had institutions or governments in Europe, for example, create sustainability ministries, or which in a way suggested that the focus was less than just on one particular part of the mainstream economy. But we still have that. Most government departments are arranged by economic activity, transport, agriculture, health, and so forth. And so the question then is, how do you get some level of integration across this? And I think it would take certainly leadership and management, which includes the ability to have conversations with the private sector about what kind of relationship you then have between these parties. And part of that relationship can again be defined by a simple thing as a contract, which basically stipulates roles and responsibilities and protection of IP and so forth. Even at the commencement of conversations, often some med services don't even know that you can put together a non-disclosure agreement, right? Which basically says, I'm going to tell you stuff that you know you might not like, or that you might like and want to run with. The other guys tell you the same thing, but there's an understanding of what happens with that information when you leave that room. And for me, this also goes to boards and governors or boards of directors who often don't come from the community and therefore don't understand the nuancing of the science and how to run these institutions. So the opportunities are there, I think, to broaden the weather enterprise through the continent, but it'll take leadership and management. And part of that challenge, I think, is around how you develop the skills of those that are there, but not only those that are already in service in government, but also those that, in a sense, are coming up in training and training institutions, right? Often interventions in training for the continent, you go back to the 50s and the 60s, have been on the technical excellence. So most guys who were trained in Russia are now heads of the agencies who were trained in the 60s, for example, have now just retired, most of them actually, from being heads of med services in their countries, right? There are some who are being trained in China, for example, at the moment. Some of them can't return to the continent because their services don't have the equipment or the computing or the or not running the models, so they're not really fully engaged when they return, and they therefore go, as Makoto was saying, retention is difficult, so they go and work for the mines, because now they can speak Mandarin, and I'm just using a case from Zambia, right, where the copper mines are now employing meteorologists because they can speak Mandarin and they can pay better than the public sector. But so, yes, there is an opportunity to do so, But I think it's going to call for quite strong leadership, and the skills development for me starts even with those that are coming up, not just the training and technical excellence, but also we need to find a way of injecting leadership and management training into their programs so that it becomes part of what they want to do, stay in the public sector, but make a difference with others, in partnership with others. And again, I go back to the same problem. If you were running the country and you were faced with this problem, you would not just rely on one sole source for your information if you were a prime minister. You would rely on whatever source of data, information, intelligence is available in the country, whether private or otherwise, must give me solutions to how I mitigate these problems and how I'm able to protect, in a way, the economy. Then I think it's a policy intervention as well. So an encouraging environment created by government to say this space is okay. It's okay for the private sector to come in, and it's okay for people to collaborate, and it's okay for the public sector to open its doors to having these collaborative opportunities contracted. We create the environment where we protect through laws, et cetera, and create the space for everyone to play a role, then it can be done. It is being done in other parts of the economy. It's just not being done in med services because there is a sense that, again, it's a humanitarian intervention and not economic.
Jerry, as we all know, I think that managing public sector institutions is pretty challenging. And I wonder, what do you think could be done to sort of improve the management of public sector, particularly for, you know, current and future leaders of national meteorological and hydrological services?
Well, I think that one of the things we can do is actually piggyback either on existing programs. The WMO, for example, has a capacity development program. The National Met Services themselves have programs. I know certainly the weather service that I used to head up had an agreement with Exeter where you could send people for technical training and so forth. But I think where it is lacking in all these programs of capacity development, capacity intervention, is actually on the training on leadership and management. And so one of the proposals is to have an institute or an academy which is dedicated to this, because again, purely because of this value cycle of managing a service of this nature. It's not your run-of-the-mill institution that can be run by everybody. It can be run by everybody, but with the right information and knowledge, they can be taken to level of excellence. And so there's two choices really with this kind of academy: is do you make it a for-profit or for non-profit? And if it's for non-profit, then I think that's probably the best model for it, which then allows access to that for those that are in service. But it has to be a very dedicated program where people will have to spend time in learning. And obviously, in the end, there's some certification that goes out. So that concept is in the mill at the moment and being discussed much more broadly. And I think one of the key questions then is, if it is to be for nonprofit, then obviously sponsorships are key to making sure that, you know, the Allens, the Davids, everyone who has an opportunity in their career to drive and to run such programs can contribute through a case study driven methodology to that narrative and the coursework and the content of this program from across the world. And that's the beauty about this, is we have a global community that has this skill set. Most of them are now retired, semi-retired, almost retired, but still, you know, engaged in the community, never leave the community. So how do we actually tap into that wealth of knowledge to ensure that it's accessible to those that may or may not even have ambition to manage such institutions in the future, right? But at least gives them an opportunity to access and tap into what it means to actually run a successful national Met Service, and as you said, in for the continent, any future institution that may be regional, sub-regional, that seeks to advance the enterprise should be able to do so. And so I think the call would be to both the private sector, donor agencies, and others to play a sponsorship role to making sure that this can happen and can happen soon.
So Makoto, do you see a specific role for the World Bank in this kind of initiative?
Well, of course, we cannot underestimate the role of senior management and leaders to move the needle, right? And it is important that development partners like the World Bank to empower leaders to make a difference. I think in the current situation, NMHSs do need a type of leaders who can contextualize the HydroMed services in the broader political and the development context of the country. And at the end of the day, that what the government needs to do is to optimally allocate limited resources to address a number of development challenges. And NMHS should strategically position itself in that context, and the role of leaders and the senior management is huge there. As a development institution, you know, working on the broad development agenda, I think that the World Bank, the entities like World Bank, is well positioned to provide support to the NMHS leaders to strategically position their institutions in the broader development context. Well, I also think that the external partners like us can help leaders and senior managements to equip with knowledge and good practices from other countries, from other regions, and latest thinkings in the global HydroMed community, as well as potential options for development path, or so that they can make the more informed decisions. And this is indeed the area that which we do need more efforts in the future.
Well, thank you, Makoto and Jerry, for joining us today. That's been a really great conversation, and we've covered in depth a number of really critical issues for developing countries in Africa in particular. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Makoto and Jerry. That was really enlightening. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much for an interesting conversation today.